Hi guys, thank you for joining. Good afternoon, wherever you're from. I'm Jackson, and I'll be taking you through this nurse break live Q&A with two awesome ED nurses from Queensland. This is the Nurse Break Live interview, where I interview health professionals from across Australia, from all different areas and specialties and experiences, and we get some good insights into how we can all work better and about their careers. Today, we're joined by Murin and Lisa, and I'll get them on so they can introduce themselves. Yo, are you there?
Hi.
Hey. So guys who are watching, this is on your left, Murin, and on your right is Lisa. I'll let them introduce themselves because they can do it like 1,000 times better than me, but on the right, I think it's everyone's right, is Lisa, and she's an emergency nurse educator, pediatric and adults. And on our left is Murin, and she is currently in the role of the nurse unit manager. So I'll leave it to you guys to introduce yourselves.
Hi everyone. I've been ED nursing for about 14 years. Fell into it, was never planning to go to ED, was an oncology nurse first, and there just was a job opening, so I thought give it a crack and fell in love with it, never left. I've worked all around Australia, did a little bit of travelling, so moved around. I've been in most grade 7 roles. Didn't like the nurse manager role very much, so I didn't stay in that for very long. I did about a month, and that was about it. Otherwise, I've done mostly clinical stuff until I became the educator 4 years ago. But I've done trauma centres, I've done rural centres, and now I'm in a large metropolitan ED in Queensland.
Awesome.
Three.
Keep you busy.
Yeah, I would, yeah.
So my name is Murin. Similar to Lisa, I've done most of my career in ED, which is probably about 13 or 14 years now as well. In case you couldn't tell by the accent, I started my career in Ireland. So a little bit of an adjustment when we moved to Queensland 7 years ago. So since I've been here, I've worked always in ED, but in multiple kind of different roles. So I've done some education, clinical facilitator, clinical nurse consultant, and now I'm acting in a nurse unit manager role for the first time, which is bringing its own challenges. And I live here with my husband and my small boy, Ollie.
Awesome. Anyone who's watching, if we have some lag in internet connections, just bear with us. My Wi-Fi might decide to run away and I'll have to connect my 3G. So just bear with us, okay? This is live. So you're in Queensland, you left Ireland. Do you go back?
I've been back loads, not since COVID, obviously. We'll probably go back once every year, usually for weddings and events. But we're here to stay with no real intention of, you know, moving back to Ireland to live at any point in the future. So
it's too cold, yeah. Too wet.
Yes, too wet.
My last, one of my the interviews before this was Simon. He's an ED nurse practitioner. He was our second Q&A, and he's also from Ireland, and I pronounced his city completely incorrectly. And it looks like all your Irish nurses are coming to the land down under. Guys have co-founded PodNed. PodNed is a podcast for emergency nurses by emergency nurses, which is pretty cool. There's not many podcasts in Australia. There's probably on one or two hands I could count how many. And what is it all about?
Well, exactly what you said is why we decided to start it. I kind of roped Murin in because I didn't want to do it on my own. But I love podcasts. So I commute quite a bit to work, and that's what I listen to. So, and it used to frustrate me. There was Australian medical emergency, and there's lots of education-based stuff, but I just wanted something that was a little bit of a mixture, but was very focused on how we do things here in Australia. So I thought, well, if I can't find one, I'll make one. And then I told Murin the idea.
Then she dragged me along.
Yeah. And then we were about to start and COVID hit. So then we had a little bit of a delayed start, and then we figured we better get cracking. It's one of those things, it just stays an idea. So we kicked off a few months ago, But yeah, it's, we already have such a long list of, you know, ideas on what we can talk about and do, and it's really starting to take off. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, so there's a million things you could do. I'm really excited to see what's happening.
Yeah, we're very excited.
Yeah, it's very much trial and error at this point in time. And, you know, some of our ideas obviously aren't quite suitable for podcast distribution. And then sometimes creating content, like for me, unlike Lisa, I didn't listen to work podcasts. I listened to podcasts about serial killers. So that's not really translated to emergency nursing podcasts. So it's definitely been a steep learning curve to try and make content relevant and something that people want to listen to. So
we also wanted to make sure it was enjoyable, not just dry. We like to laugh. We like to be entertained. So we didn't want to, you know, create just a boring podcast. Yeah. It was all education. As much as I love education, that wasn't the whole point of it.
So, yeah, because there's some that exist and they're like very clinical based, you know, it'll be a clinical topic. But yours are, I've listened to all three of yours. Who have you had on so far and sort of what are the sort of like the things you're talking about?
The first episode was just the two of us and we made it, you know, present to the current climate. We thought we'll tell people how it was for us when COVID came our way. Now we have a couple of, we have one person that's decided that they're in, our beautiful friend Gav or Carolyn. She's crazy Scott. She's fame hungry, isn't she?
Yeah, she wants to be in every episode, so we've got to figure out how to do that.
Just put her photo on the side.
Yeah.
She's good fun, though. Good crack. And the second one was good fun, wasn't it? We did
We had a few people, told a few stories. We were all sitting around a table, so it was like just having a chat and a bit of a laugh. And then the leadership one was the most recent one, which we did probably more formal, like where we interviewed people about their experiences. And that's gone down really well. People like have given us really good feedback about that. So we're kind of learning from each episode that we put out what people like and what they don't like. So
they seem to be getting a little longer too, because we get, you know, a little more comfortable platform and a little bit more, you know, we've sort of got our groove. We kind of had like a practice run when COVID hit too, because we started doing Facebook Lives for the team so that everyone could stay up to date. So we were able to, you know, get our nerves out on how we can present and talk.
And they also started terribly,
really bad,
and got progressively better as the pandemic progressed. So we learned a few things from that too.
Yeah, even Kathy, our director, said, "You're getting much better. It's much, much better to watch."
Okay. So as in you're like doing, so everyone who's watching, before I continue, if you have any questions for these two, anything nursing related, chuck them down in the comments. And I'll get them to choose which question they like the most. And I might send a little prize to whoever it is to your address. So come on, post your questions. I know there's like five already. So are you doing like your training for your staff through Facebook Live? Because where I'm work, it's through all these other like.
We did a little bit of education updates, but most of our education and training, particularly for COVID, the team and I filmed it. So that we had videos and then we've created them.
It's all on a website, like an internal website, so they can access it at home. And
but
so, no, so you like filming it. So you like filming how to work. Yeah, sorry.
We went on, you know, how to set up the ventilator on SIMV, and we did one on how to set up the bag valve mask for a COVID patient with the filter, and you know, like little things, but they're very short videos. But it was about trying to get the content out to a huge group, you know, in a small amount of time.
Yeah, and I think because it changed so quickly, like every day we'd come to work, there was new changes. We were struggling to keep up and we were getting like direct feed of information. So you're thinking, how the hell are people who are working shift work and they might not work for 5 days and they come back and everything's completely changed? How are they going to keep up with what's happening? You haven't got a hope unless, you know, so we thought that was maybe a better way of reaching a larger volume of people, because I'm sure you guys were the same, but the number of emails and broadcasts and statewide level stuff that was getting distributed to churn through to try and find what was relevant for you was really hard.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The staff wanted to know what was specifically relevant for them.
Yeah.
And what were the changes in our department and how did they have to, you know, operate.
I mean, every day, yeah, literally, I probably get on average like 13 emails a day just as a nurse on the floor in ED. Day four as an ED nurse. So even I am very excited to hear what insights I can get from you guys. What is it about emergency nursing that you guys love?
I reckon it is like you either love it or you hate it. There's no in between.
Yeah.
And you'll know as soon as you start whether it's for you or not. I always thought I was going to hate it, but I love that the people are always the same type of people. And so you generally get on really well with everybody. But I love the fast pace, the excitement. It's never boring. There's always plenty to do. You're always amongst the action as well.
Yeah. I think for me, and like, because I did 12 months of medical and surgical nursing as a new grad before I went to ED, and I was contemplating whether I was even going to stay as a nurse or whether I was going to leave, and I got offered a position in ED, and I just didn't look back. And I think part of that was the people, and then part of it was the autonomy that came with that, because I used to get really frustrated on the ward that you have to wait for a doctor or an intern to come and do something, and that might be 3 or 4 hours, and it used to frustrate me so much. And then all of a sudden I was in an environment where you had autonomy, you could do stuff yourself, or if you did need someone, they were there. So I think, you know, the pace and being able to do all that stuff, and then the people were great. They just got on with it, worked hard.
Yeah, totally. And where you guys work or previously, I mean, we have the nurse practitioners who are very autonomous. What, just for the general ED nurse where you guys work, are you able to order path results independently? What's the difference in scope versus the ward that you experience?
Currently, we can nurse initiate pathology, nurse initiate analgesia, nurse initiate X-ray, and we're just working on packages so that we can do plastering, and we'll start doing other competencies like some of our staff can do ultrasound guided cannulas at the moment. And so we're just expanding that, and we'll ABG start doing sampling. ABG sampling as well.
As in, what do you mean? Oh, like actually taking the bloods, yeah.
Yeah, we'll do the ABG stab, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. And what differentiates, I guess, ED nursing, like what sort of aspects? So I've written there like violence, because we do. I mean, that's in everywhere. These are sort of things that happen everywhere in nursing, but sort of what would you say is the big thing that differentiates ED nurses, ED nursing?
From other types of nursing, you mean?
From other areas.
I think the biggest one, if I had to pick one thing for me, it's probably the team. How closely people work together, you know, the relationship between all the disciplines, how everybody just mucks in and gets a job done. And
it is
a true multidisciplinary team, I suppose, rather than people talk about it, but that's not actually the reality. I think for me, if I was to pick one thing, that would be what differentiates it for me.
I agree 100%. Coming from the wards where it's you still have a tight nursing team in some units, but not like you do in ED, and then the whole, you know, wider healthcare team is very close, and there's no... There doesn't appear to be a hierarchy system. It's just all muck in and get the job done.
So what's an example? Is it in regards to where everyone congregates? I mean, I've only just started in ED, and, you know, I've noticed a big difference in 4 days. But even just the location of the staff room, everyone's sharing things. That's one very simple difference I've noticed.
We even do education together. Like, we don't separate most things.
Yeah, we scrum together, you've got education together, you know, you have your lunch break together, you socialise together outside of work.
Yeah.
And then how you work together as a team on the floor with very little hierarchy. I love that. I think it's great.
Yeah.
And that's sort of I am going to do some Q&As where I have people from the multidisciplinary team. So I'll have an ED nurse consultant or whoever, an ED doctor, an ED social worker, for any area, cardiac, mental health. And that's sort of the idea of this before COVID. because we are one big team, really.
Yeah. We'll have different healthcare professionals on the podcast as well.
Yeah.
Because it's
exactly
is they're part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Guys, there's heaps of questions coming through. So, wow. Okay. Keep doing that. Now, I hate this question. I hate being asked it, but I'm going to ask you it because I hate it. Dinner table talk. Everyone's like, oh my God, you're an ED nurse or you're a nurse. What's the craziest, most screwed up thing, disgusting thing you've ever seen? What do you say to that?
I also hate that question. I think I learned a lesson like early on when people ask that question, they don't really want to know the most screwed up thing you've ever seen. And something that we see as like our everyday normal business, people are horrified at, you know, they just think like, I don't know, you know, to most people, even a very basic task like cleaning somebody like who's incontinent or something is like they cannot even comprehend that. So for us, the crazy stuff, they like, they just,
they don't really know what they're asking, I think. And
yeah, you should be very careful.
You're not ready for it. Are you ready for the truth?
Yeah. You got to be careful what your answer
and
is.
And our scale of crazy and screwed up is completely different to the normal public. My husband can't cope with it even after all these years. So my response is usually that depends what you mean by crazy or cool.
When you come home.
Blood and guts, I mean, or, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you actually want to know? I could tell you a lot of things. You come home from a shift and like thousands of nurses experience this, and your partner isn't a health professional, maybe not a cop or someone who isn't in emergency services. Do you debrief with him? I was going to get to a question about self-care later, but like, how do you do that? What advice do you have to people whose partner just doesn't get what just happened in their crazy shit shift?
I remember the first time Michael, my husband, saw me do CPR. This was pre-ED nursing. And it was bystander. And he couldn't believe I was capable of that. And by then I'd already been a nurse for nearly a decade. So he knew I did it, just not being able to join the two. So, no, I don't debrief with him at all. That's what she's for.
We use each other.
You know, the team are for.
Yeah.
Michael's understanding of a bad day for me is if I walk in, I say, today's no good day, leave me. Yep. Or give me a glass of wine, or that's all he wants. He doesn't need to know ins and outs. He provides support because he knows bad is, compared to other professions, is pretty bad.
Yeah. Like sometimes I'll say, you know, oh, we had a, you know, particularly bad whatever case, and it, you know, Dave is very happy to listen, but you kind of, I have that understanding that he just doesn't understand what that would actually feel like. You know, I think they're very sympathetic and want to help, but I think the biggest thing for me is talking it through with people who actually understand. So you don't really need to explain why you feel the way you do. You just tell the story and they instantly get it and know where you're coming from
and have probably felt it, so you don't have to explain how you feel. It's much easier to debrief that stuff with each other. Whereas like we've had a couple of really crazy days at work separately, which is unusual. But our husbands, we were just speaking about how we came home and everything's done, everything's sorted, everything's cool, and that's how they support. They just know lucky. That a lot.
Very lucky. Yeah. It's amazing.
You can write some tips on how you find someone then. There's some money in that, I'm sure. What are the five main clinical presentations that you guys see in your ED? Like if someone was going to go to ED, like what are they going to see lots of?
Depends on the ED, firstly. Ours is pediatric and adults. It depends on what you mean.
I think which one? For adults, it would be, they're pretty standard, mostly medical, chest pains, abdo pains.
Respiratory arrest.
Respiratory stuff.
Stroke seems to be stroke. Stroke symptoms come through a lot.
Yeah.
And then if you're in a trauma center, you get to see, you know, all of that as well.
Yeah.
Pediatrics though, febrile illness,
respiratory
distress, rashes. Same as it's pretty diverse, it's very cool, but you do get the very similar presentations day in, day out.
Yeah.
you get used to the same sort of thing, sort of process. I'll just, there's like heaps of questions, but I've got heaps for you as well. We're going to talk about everything from leadership to models of care to everything, but I'll just pop up a question that's come through. Okay, Patrick is a grad RN and he says, what is the most desirable skill or personal attribute required for emergency nurses in the workplace?
We just did a podcast on this, Patrick. So if you listen to episode 2.
Go yeah. Listen, Patrick, to that.
Yeah. The most desirable skill, I think. There's many skills, but one of the best things that, in fact, we spoke about at the podcast was the diversity, the ability to just switch it up, to be able to be compassionate here, to be able to be, you know, jovial over here with the little person that is scared, like to be able to be diverse is
I think as well, like as coming from a NOM point of view, I don't really expect graduates to have particular skills in relation to ED because it's our job to teach you those skills. So I think for me it comes down to you know, work ethic and team fit, and you know, somebody who's operates with, you know, honesty and integrity and wants to come to work every day and is really happy to be there, because you can teach skills.
The learning just never stops in ED as well. So you have to be passionate about, you know, growth and personal growth, professional growth, education, because you'll constantly be learning.
Yeah.
You don't join ED just to be in the cubicle. You get to ED because you want to get to resus. You want to become a nurse practitioner. You want to, you know, that's the sort of type of keep going.
In ED where you want to stay, you know, you might.
You still got to keep
go to
changing.
Triage, and that's fine for you, but you still have to keep learning. You still have to keep, you know, investing in your education, because otherwise you get stagnant and get complacent, and that's not safe.
Yeah. Okay, another question from Daz. There's heaps coming through, but this is about AENs. AENs in ED or ENs in ED, do you see a role in emergency for AENs, and how can this be promoted and expanded?
So we do have ENs in our ED. The kind of FTE is certainly much less than registered nurses, but our guys work with a pretty large scope and they do most of what our registered nurses do. There's obviously some limitations just due to the registration, but our guys generally work autonomously within their scope in RED, doing all the same things that registered nurses do. So there's definitely a role for ENs. And if you were to ask any of our team, certainly that work there, I would think they'll tell you they love it. And I think about expanding the role, you know, it obviously has some restrictions, but there are advanced scope skills that have specific training and things affiliated with it that you can attend. So IV competencies and IV medications and stuff.
Okay. I'll skip the questions for a bit now. So how do you become a NUM?
By accident.
Question for both of us.
I mean, I know the background to how, but for you, but yeah. But there's also a lot of hard work and there's different ways to become NUM.
Is
there a particular course?
No.
We've done a lot of work on succession planning for particular roles because our journey to both our roles was completely
different.
So we wanted to create a nice streamlined approach for the staff who decided that, yes, that's the role I want to go to. How do I get there? Yeah,
I think for me, it probably was never in like my master plan to say I want to be a nurse unit manager. But I've always worked in ED, and my substantive position is a clinical nurse consultant. And to me, that was like the best job in the world. Absolutely adored it. And then I think I was looking for a new challenge, and I got the opportunity to do this in an acting, like in a temporary capacity for some leave. And I said yes to that opportunity, really not knowing what I was getting myself into at all. But it's been a really good kind of chance to take. And I think I've done that a few times, just within the ED, just taking a chance and trying something to see if I like it. And I think even if you don't like something, you still learn something that you'll take back to, you know, your whatever your substantive position is.
And I guess there's lots of ways to become an educator as well. What is a day in the life? You've both been CNCs, clinical nurse consultants. So I might ask you, what's a day in the life, or a typical day, if that's even a thing, for a CNC? Like, what does a CNC do?
The consistent
CNC is a
thing.
Jack of all trades. That's what they are. That's how I explain it.
I would say
if you just, with that question about how to become a NUM or educator, the CNC role would be a great stepping stone for anybody that wants to do any grade 7 role, because it makes you so diverse and you network so much to be able to fulfill that role, that then it gives you a chance to step into something like educator or NUM. I'm not saying it's the only path. It's certainly the path we both took, but both accidentally, because I wanted the CNC role for the same reasons that Marin did. I loved it. Yeah. But it's so, you're so many things every day. I think you've got to be the manager when the manager's not there. You've got to be the educator when the educator's not there. You've got to put out fires all over the department.
Yeah. I was going to say the consistent thing, if you were to ask any CNC about what they do, is probably just put out spot fires all day, every day.
Yeah. And answer the phone a thousand times.
And just solve problems that, you know, arise on a shift that needs somebody who knows the systems and the processes and the people, the right people to talk to. That's what you do.
They can go from helping a staff with their, you know, personal problem to being in the resus and leading that, to going and helping, you know, a problem in the waiting room. You know, they're just
fixing
everywhere.
Fixing rosters, fixing staffing. They do everything.
Sounds like you need a few more of those in every department. Your dog in the background is like having a fun time.
Sorry. My neighbors started building a swimming pool today, and the dogs don't like the digger.
It is a really good role, and I know I recommend that if people aren't sure of their pathway, but they know they love ED and they know they love the action, that the CNC role will basically set you up to be anything.
Sort of going on from that, I think a colleague of yours at your ED asked this one. When we're talking about stepping into leadership roles or the next clinical role for your staff members, how do you know when someone is ready to step up?
That's a really hard question. I think there's a few things. So I think, you know, if it's a clinical role, there has to be a certain level of clinical skill and clinical, I suppose, expectation or excellence there. And I think hopefully for our staff, we now have a more robust way of and streamlined way of making sure that that happens progressively throughout their ED journey. So I think there's definitely a clinical expectation. And then I think for me, a lot of the other stuff is around how people behave and role modeling behaviors and I suppose almost behaving as, say, for example, to go from RN to CN, that they would be operating almost at that level prior to receiving, you know, the promotion or the title, because they just work at that high level. They're good at leading the team and they run a tight shift and they have high expectations and all of that. So it's a bit, I think it's kind of multifaceted, really. Mm. They need to do lots of things.
I know when we're looking at progression, you know, the team that is involved in the recruitment of the next role will, you know, draw on everybody's opinion and experiences with that person. Like, it's never a single person decision. It's always, you know, multifactorial. Even when we're deciding who goes for resus training, we talk about that amongst as a group, so that we can make sure that person is the most supported as they step into that next role as well. It's not just about who's the best person for the job. It's how can we support this person because we know that's where they want to be.
Do you sometimes take, so if you've got a new, like a CNC role pops up, do you also interview staff that have never worked in your AD, or do you find that you'd like to have staff who have been in the AD rather than, you know, external nurse?
It depends a lot on the position. So a lot of our temporary backfill for, you know, maternity leave or whatever comes internally, because we have enough talent and people who are already working at that level ready to step up. And we would run kind of, you know, an internal expression of interest for that. If there's permanent positions and stuff that come up, that would be advertised externally.
Okay. Got a question from Ed. What's that?
We do try and grow our own, but that doesn't mean we don't take people from outside. So, yeah.
Cool. Ben has asked, I love the cue at the start, Ben. Very, very nice question. What's a better new grad pathway? Being an AD nurse first, or the critical care ICU, CCU, and then to AD?
I don't think there is a better way.
No, I think it depends what you want. And I think both have their benefits. I think working outside of an AD environment in a more controlled environment gives you different skills if and when you do go to ED. So, you know, even basic things as a new grad, like time management and medication rounds and managing all of that and having time to learn that stuff in detail is certainly, you know, that gives you really good skill if you were to come to ED later. But we have grads that come straight to ED and they never cease to amaze me. They literally just hit
the
ground
running.
They're
so good.
They just go.
And I've worked in facilities that don't have graduate nurses in ED. They just won't employ graduate nurses until they've done at least a year. And I think they're missing something. I really do, because our grads are fantastic and because they're growing in that environment. So by the time they get to the second year, they've got the basics of ED nailed and they grow really quickly. So I think there's benefits to both, like Miran said, but yeah, I think there's definitely a place in ED for grads.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, my first Q&A was with Ben, a different Ben, and he was in ED first and then ICU for the second year. And he said he found a lot of, from some nurses, disagreement with the fact that you should be in ED first and you should not be in a specialty area, but you could argue that all areas of nursing are specialty. What is one piece of education that you give or you wish you could give to everyone coming into ED for the first time? What's the most important thing you think everyone should know?
I think the biggest thing that people struggle with when they come to ED is the ability to prioritize and time manage, because it's such a hectic environment and it's such a huge turnover that the ability to spot a deteriorating patient and quickly prioritize what needs to be done is the thing that people struggle with the most. But it's something that I don't think you can teach going into it. You have to be prepared for it. You have to be willing to speak up when you're not okay. And I think that's the best thing about ED. Lots of people say they're scared to go to ED because it's, you know,
it's so busy.
But actually there's so many people that you only need to be scared if you're too scared to ask for help. That's the only time you need to be scared, because there's so many people around willing to help that you should be asking.
Yeah.
And then you just learn. You just learn from the people around you. But I think that's probably the biggest thing.
Yeah.
And yourself, Miran, or is that the same sort of thing?
Yeah, I think it's the same. I think the biggest thing is letting people know that it's okay to ask, and it's okay that not everything gets done. You know, it's a 24/7 service that you are one person, you've got one pair of hands, and it's not always possible to get all of your work done, and that's okay. And that's why we hand over to somebody else that's coming, and that's why that person hands over, because things change all the time. Workloads change, treatment plans change, and as one person with multiple patients, you can't keep up with all of that for all of your patients, and that's entirely fine. So I think letting people know exactly what Lisa said, just ask for help.
Good advice. Now, sort of going on that, is what is the most difficult thing to teach? I asked a nurse practitioner, an AD nurse practitioner, he said he finds teaching the oxygen hemoglobin disassociation curve quite difficult. What do you find?
I'm tackling that at the moment, actually, on how to teach that in the simplest way. What's the easiest way to make people help people understand that? But I've found from all my nursing, ventilation seems to just make people's mind explode when you start talking about it, because there's so
good
much.
In a bad way.
In a bad way. There's so much to take in, and we're usually trying. Well, particularly in our facility, we're getting them to, you know, try and understand this at the same time that they're trying to learn just resuscitation in general. So it's really, really quite difficult for people. So, but the thing I always tell all my staff is, you know, stop trying to learn the end result and just start trying to learn the basics the same way. You don't run before you walk. So stop trying to run and just start learning the ins and outs, the, you know, the really basic mechanics. But I find ventilation, yeah, oxygen dissociation curve really hard to make simple. Okay. But I think we've nailed the ventilation. Our staff are really good at it. We've been very fortunate with the education team that we have this, you know, that they've mastered that art, I think.
Yep. Okay. Mirren, what's one thing you wish you would have known before you started in ED?
Oh, God. I don't know. Probably I'm trying to think back of, you know, when I started, things that scared me. And I think I remember someone saying to me, because I was quite upset that this patient had deteriorated and I felt like I'd missed something completely and it was all my fault and the person was going to die because of me and all of that. And this really senior nurse, this was back in Ireland, turned to me and she said, "It's okay, you didn't make him sick," you know, and I was like, it was mind blowing. I was like, oh my God, she's right. I didn't make him sick. Yeah, wow, it wasn't my fault. I didn't kill the patient. And I remember, because I think you're so much, you know, you're trying so hard to do such a good job in really challenging circumstances, and patients do deteriorate and sometimes, you know, unexpectedly. And I think as a junior nurse in ED that, you take that quite personally sometimes, especially if you've spent a long time looking after the patient. And I wished someone had told me that. It probably wouldn't have sunk in, to be honest, until I'd experienced that. But, you know, it was like mind-blowing that I hadn't made this. It wasn't something that I had done to make this patient deteriorate. And I think sometimes when you only have a limited amount of knowledge and, you know, you're junior to ED and you don't have all of the answers to your questions or the full understanding of why someone has deteriorated, it's very easy to blame yourself that you've missed something. That's probably something I wish I'd known.
Yeah. And yourself, Lisa?
I think that it's okay to not know everything. You know, it was quite frightening when it first started and I'd often feel stupid for the questions I'd ask, but every time I'd say, "Can I just ask a stupid question?" and I'd try and pull it aside so I didn't look ridiculous, there's no stupid question. And it's much, much safer and much more comforting to just say, "I actually don't know. Can you tell me?" And I still do it now. If somebody asks me a question, I say, "I actually don't know. Let's go find out." Because you'll never know everything. You'll never walk into an environment and be able to just know. So, the phrase "they should have known that" or "I should have known that" is probably my favorite phrase.
Did you do that at the same time? Okay, so there are lots of challenges. This is sort of a different topic, but there are lots of challenges in nursing, in ED nursing, that I don't know, but I would assume they're probably unique to it, such as access block and overcrowding. And that has the back on flow through the hospital. In particular, there's a lot of acute violence and aggression. There's the NEAT principles, the 4-hour rule, you have to get someone in and out. And there's lots of different models of care. So I guess my first one would be, how do we manage KPIs and versus patient-centered care? Like, that's a tricky one, but that's a nurse at my emergency department who just asked me to ask that question.
Innovation, I think, is how we've done it.
Yeah, and I think remembering that KPIs are fine and they're made to suit most patients. So not all patients fit into boxes and should meet KPIs for patient safety reasons, or, you know, the 4-hour rule, fantastic for most patients. But there are some patients that, you know, for various reasons, the ED is the safest environment for them to be. I think access block, anybody that works in ED, it's probably one of their biggest bugbears about working there. And I think the reason we hate it so much is because we feel like we can't give patient-centered care. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're trying to do your job and trying to do it well, but you're in a corridor that doesn't even have a sink, or, you know, you can't even do basic things like wash your hands in between patients. Like, the logistics of trying to do your job well are just really, really difficult. And I think anybody who works in ED will know that and know exactly what that feels like. So I think KPIs have their place. Clearly, they don't always work because access block exists. So we don't obviously all meet them all of the time. But I think some of them are really good to strive for. You know, some of the organizational ones are patient focused, you know, around pressure injury care and medication safety, and, you know, they're really ones that, as nursing, that's our core business, and we should aim to meet them really well, because if we do, we are giving safe patient care. So I think it's kind of a bit of a double whammy. I think it depends what KPIs you're talking about. A lot of them are organizational as opposed to patient, but then there are ones that are very much made for patient safety.
And how do, I mean, I don't know a lot, to be honest, with the models of care in ED, but I have a general understanding. What sort of model of care do you guys use in your ED? You know, you have the fast track, the SSU, there's all these different sort of models, and the hospital that's left is very different to the one I'm currently at in regards to how they manage their flow and how they separate peds and adults.
It depends on the setup you have. And it depends on the demographic that you see as to what kind of models of care you need. I've worked in heaps of different EDs with very diverse different models of care. You have to adjust the models of care to suit the facility and not vice versa. While you can have, you know, standardized ones across, you know, the state and the country that generally work, they don't work for everybody. And so I think you have to be a little innovative, and I think you have to think a little bit outside the box, be as useful as you can with the space that you have. And then you have to think about, it's not just about the physical setup of the ED and what the ED is dealing with, it's also the hospital. You know, our ED is huge compared to our hospital is very small. So, you know, we have to be quite innovative within the department because we know that the structure isn't there for the rest of the hospital, whereas other facilities have a very different approach to access block because they have a different block. So you have to change up your models of care to suit you. Some of ours are very different to the rest of the state because it's just, that's what works for us.
Yeah. There's so much comes into making a model of care. It's also resourcing it. We could make massive changes to 5 different models of care in the morning if someone was to say, here's 25 staff for you. I think you have to, exactly what Lisa said, it just has to be tailored to your facility, your resources, and your patient demographic.
Money helps the models of care.
What are some examples of the models of care? Like, I probably didn't actually say what they are.
We have a beautiful new mental health lounge in the middle of our department. We had a wasted space, we got some funding, and we created a mental health lounge. Has been pretty game changer for our mental health patients.
Yeah, that's working really well. And then we do have standard ones like short stay unit, which most EDs will have. And obviously you can tailor that to your type of patients that you see. And then
we actually don't have a fast track. We have an ambulatory care area, which is a bit of it's a hybrid of a lot of facilities, fast tracks, and they're sort of minor injury and illness area. And then we run a clinical decisions unit as well, which it depends on the department as to what that looks like and what kind of patient presentations go into it. But we use it for chest pain patients, syncope, abdo pain.
Do you have nurse practitioners in your ED or previous EDs you've worked in? And where do you find that they normally, I mean, the ones I've spoken to work everywhere. They have to be competent everywhere, but a lot of them find themselves in the plastering, the broken bones area. Where, in your experience, where do you allocate your NPs?
That's probably similar to us. We have some NPs that work both adult and pediatrics, and then we have some specific pediatric only NPs. And they would primarily work with minor injuries and illness.
Okay. Violence is another sort of big issue in ED. What's your experience with aggression, inappropriate behavior, you know, just lewd comments and crazy things? And how do ADs manage this better? I mean, is there even enough security?
So we've done a lot of work on this. Our social demographic where our ED is, we see a lot of drug affected patients attend our department, and we have a large mental health cohort of patients that also use the service. So it's something we're very familiar with, unfortunately. It's something that we haven't had a very good experience with probably over the last, increasingly over the last 5 years, with multiple serious occupational violence incidents, which is not okay. So some of the things that we've done to tackle it is that we set up an internal working group, and we involved occupational health and safety representation with that, also safety and response team representation, and then clinician representation. And very recently, through that process, we've developed a new kind of response model for occupational violence. So it's a designated response team that will attend all incidents within the ED. So you'll get a senior consultant, a CNC, an ED ambassador, and some safety and response representatives. So we're trying to make early clinical decisions for these patients about how best to manage their behavior. And the feedback so far is pretty good. It's still gaining momentum, but I think it's probably going to be a bit of a game changer for us. The other thing, as Lisa mentioned, was having a physical space that is a nice, pleasant space to be, that's less clinical or less treatment looking.
Noisy.
Yeah, less noisy is our mental health lounge, and that's been a huge game changer for us as well.
I think how we could do it better is not necessarily how we respond, because like Miriam said, we've done a lot of work in that, is that education, there isn't a great deal for us to provide the staff, and it's not something that as nurses or physicians that we can teach. We need external, you know, providers. So that's, I think that's difficult. And I don't think in any facility I've worked in, there's been a great deal of education for the staff on how to respond to keep themselves safe and the people around them safe.
Yeah. I just left the Alfred Hospital, and I mean, it was mandatory for all staff to do. I was on a trauma ward, so there's a lot of violence and aggression, a lot from drugs. It was mandatory for staff to do de-escalation and martial arts, effectively, like how to get out of chokehold and all these sort of things, training. So we had a very hands-on one full day seminar. And another thing that the Alfred has been doing is they have what's known as a divert program. So if we recognize someone who might go to a code gray, is we send off a divert. It's like a pre-code gray, and the psych team, the medical team, the social workers, whatever, will respond to that. And if it returns, becomes a code gray, it becomes a code gray. But it's like preventing it before it happens and finding what are the triggers. We need a plan.
Yeah. And that's similar to what we're trying to do, is just front load senior clinical opinion and decision making for these patients. So, you know, to try and prevent getting to that point.
Okay. So guys, I'll get to some more questions, but keep posting your questions. And like I said, I might send a gift to whoever my two guests like the question the most. That was really bad English. what's the question I should put up? Um, Taylor, that question's been answered. She's just asking about what are EDs looking for in a grad nurse. And effectively, Taylor, they've pretty much said nothing really. They're going to teach you it all, but being proactive. Another question is, do you have any good resources for time management in going into second year EM placements? I plan, let's just say going into emergency, I plan to use a calendar system, but I'm struggling to find good resources or templates. So how do you recommend people time manage an emergency?
It's really difficult, and I would suggest that a template in an emergency environment is probably not the greatest method.
Just going flat.
Typical on a live, isn't it? So I think a calendar template probably wouldn't be useful, because I think the patients turn over too quickly and you'd spend your whole time trying to fill it out and update your patients because they move. Okay. Because they move from place to place, you know, even within the ED, they don't stay in a particular cubicle, for example, and then they move short stay and then they go here and there. So I've used the calendar kind of system or template in ward nursing, which where it is helpful. That's probably not a very helpful answer, I realise, because I've told you like not to do that and I haven't given you a suggestion of what to do instead.
I don't think there's any secret answer for that one. Sorry.
We're plugged in now. Okay. All good. I think that comes with experience too, you know, it's what you see and it's what you experience, and then the next day you come to work, you kind of go, oh well, I've seen this, so I know what I need to do for this patient. And because it ED doesn't work on a timetable in the same way that a ward does, you know, around time of medication administration, you don't use set ward rounds. I think some of that just comes with experience, and then knowing the things that you need to do for a particular patient presentation would help you with time management. For example, if you get a chest pain patient in and you know I need to do A, B, C, D for those patients, and they're the first four things I do for all chest pain patients, and you get a bit of a system going. But there's probably no perfect
There isn't template. Really a resource that can help you.
My advice would be, having done this for 4 days, is, yeah.
Oh, no, go.
Sorry, okay. My internet's, I don't know, the internet's just carked it. yeah, shift planner. Don't even try in an ED.
That's about as good as you can get. It's just the shift planner, so you know what you're working. But as far as a resource when you're on shift, it's
really hard, yeah.
Yeah. My husband likes to tell me I can't multitask. I can multitask. I can. A good skill, being able to multitask in an ED, is probably as good advice that we can give, really.
I think even before that, it's just being able to just try to focus on, if you are a student listening, just be safe. Just focus on your assessments. Know how to recognize deterioration. And really, that's all you need to know for now. The rest
things matter. OBS, sugar, GCS, they all matter. As much as you might think it's the big stuff, it's really not.
No.
It's the basics that are key. Yeah.
Know your doctor's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, back to front. Okay, so another unique thing to eat, well, don't know if it's unique. It's not necessarily unique, but being assertive as nurses is very important for advocating for our patients. So I sort of wanted to touch on an acronym that I came across last year, which I've only had to use twice, once in a pre-hospital environment, one in hospital, is advocating for patients in graded assertiveness, which we use an acronym called PACE. And I've just gone blank what it stands for, but I think it's probe, alert, challenge.
Correct.
And then emergency. Explode. So can you talk about, I guess, do you have an example that you can think of, that without breaching confidentiality, about when you've had to advocate very strongly and how you sort of how that happened?
Too many times, I would say. Yeah. I suppose without using specific examples, it's really useful tool, especially if you are a more junior nurse or unfamiliar with the team that you're working with. And if, you know, the further along through the acronym that you go, the more difficult it is for people to refuse, which is a really good thing for the patients. So I personally haven't ever really gotten to the end of that acronym because people have listened prior to that point. And I think it's just about how you articulate. And I think if you are concerned for your patient, having all of the information, think about if you were the person receiving the escalation, you know, think about if you were the doctor receiving handover, you don't just want, hey, my patient's really sick. You want, you know, the name, the patient, where they're located, what they've come in with. You know, you need to give a really systematic handover, and it needs to be in language that they understand. And so I think sometimes we can even avoid getting to having to use PACE by giving a good handover prior to that. Do you reckon?
Sorry, I'm just mid-COVID emergency text. Apologies.
I think Jackson's internet is gone too.
He has frozen. Wonderfully frozen.
I don't know. We can just wait for it to kick back in.
Yeah.
The joys of alive.
Yep. Someone's trying to get on to me from the clinic.
Or?
I don't know. So I'm just going to send them.
It's not our internet.
I don't know.
It's gone.
Okay.
We'll just stay in this. I'm assuming he can join back.
That's who's been trying to call me. I thought it was Donna. Damn. Mm-hmm.
We couldn't answer it anyway.
No.
We're back. Don't know if anyone can hear this, but slight live technical issues. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes, we can.
Okay, it must have been me. That's actually never happened before, so I'm sorry, but not sorry. I don't know how to even prevent that ever happening. So
we just had our own little chat.
Yeah, I had a slight emergency to deal with, but all good.
Okay, good. Sorry. Oh well, let's sort of. We've still got 28 people watching, so yay. Let's sort of wrap this up shortly. So can you still hear me? Yep, you're still there. Okay. So you guys were involved in some research. Well, you both have been, but Muren, you were involved in QUADS, so the Queensland Adult Deterioration Detection System. And it's all about improving, recognizing deteriorating patients in ED. Can you talk about that and I guess sort of the lessons learned?
Yeah, look, it's a couple of years ago now, but we did, we were having some issues with compliance with the system that we were using at the time. Since that time, we've moved to digital health record, but at that time we were still on paper, and we didn't have great compliance with following the escalation process associated with deteriorating patients. So we did... you were very kind to call it research, but it was a probably more a bit of a quality improvement local level, kind of just for our department. And we did, I suppose, quite simple education drives and familiarization, some education around the system itself. And did some case studies, and we had some really good results actually. So I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but we went from being pretty shy to pretty good. And we presented that at a conference, mostly because we wanted to go to Alice Springs for a little trip.
Nice.
So it was, yeah, it was good. And it, like for me, I am certainly not an academic. I can probably will never be involved in any very hectic research by choice. So I think some of, for me, that lower level, just local departmental stuff that actually makes a difference in your department and for your patients, that's the stuff that I enjoy more so than the bigger kind of academic stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Lisa, you have done some research as well, but you've also been nursing all around Australia. You've even helped with, I believe, some stuff in Nepal. Is that
me? Yeah, that was quite an experience. I used to work in North Queensland, and a lot of the doctors used to do locum work in like PNG and Nepal and those kinds of countries. And one of the consultants asked the educator at the time if he would go to, it was for a conference for emergency medicine, and then help basically have a meeting with the like the head of the nursing registration in Nepal, because they wanted to set up a postgraduate program for nurses over there because there isn't no such thing. And so I jumped on that train and went with him, and it was amazing. So we presented at the conference, and then we did some education sessions with the Nepalese nurses, who are very, very, very clever nurses. And then we got to go and tour a few of the hospitals as well. And then we, you know, met with all the board and a few of the, you know, directors of the big facilities in Nepal, and discussed, you know, what we thought was, you know, the key components to setting up a postgraduate program over there for the nurses, because they've certainly definitely got the knowledge. They just needed to have the ability to advocate, which they didn't really have a great deal of. Very different world over there, very different. And I got out 2 days before that big earthquake in the
world. Oh, no.
No, I was happy to be out.
I went to the earthquake. I went to Nepal 2 weeks after that happened and worked in, well, volunteered with some, you know, medical camp, actually, back then. Yeah, that was a crazy time. Love Nepal.
Seeing what their hospital had to deal with and how they functioned and their health system before the earthquake.
I cried
when I saw it on the TV. I thought, I couldn't comprehend that. How do you do that?
Yeah.
It was a great experience, though. Would love to go back.
Favorite country in the world. I've been to a few. My favorite. I've got two more questions for you.
Okay.
How do we prevent burnout? I need to go buy alcohol. Don't do that. Yeah, how do we prevent physical and emotional tolls of nursing in ED?
I think you have to kind of find your tribe and find your people that you work with that understand you and understand what you have to do day to day. Because, well, certainly for me personally, having people who know what we do to just talk something out with is really valuable, like in the very kind of first instance. Mm. I think you have to mind yourself and take regular leave. And I think that's something nurses are probably guilty of not doing often enough, particularly shift working nurses, because you can often get a long run of days off and you think that that's enough. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes you just need a bit more time to be with your family or, you know, doing whatever you do, and finding something that you enjoy other than wine, like something maybe a bit healthier, you know, that you can do in your downtime, and making time to do that. Because I think we probably are all guilty of not doing that enough as well.
I think culture within a department as well and morale within the department's really important. It's key to, you know, how efficient a department will run, an emergency department, because the work's tough. But if you don't have a good culture and you don't have a good morale, then it's like a cancer in the department, and the staff are going to burn out a lot quicker. So we focus a lot on culture in ED. And I know a lot of EDs like us have wellness programs for their staff, so that we are, you know, we're not just trying to deal with it in our own little pockets, because we do find you try and you do certainly, you know, debrief and support each other, but it's also important as a wider team to have that set up. So I know, there's a lot of departments around the country that have set up programs so that their staff are well supported, well taken care of.
Besides offering wine, what things like have you done to like build that culture?
We have, you know, yoga, like, you know, department-wide yoga. We have, you know, social events regularly.
So the person whose leave I'm filling at the moment had a very strong focus on changing the culture, because there was certainly issues previously within the department with poor culture. And she has put a lot of that stuff in place. So, like, you know, they got massages for staff in winter in the tea room, people that would come in, and there's so many different things.
There's even the little things, like we've set up a recess trolley for the nursing, for all the staff that sits in, the nursing staff probably rate it the most, but it sits in the tea room and it's full of snacks and, you know, that's you can just go and get, that's always stocked by the wellness group. So there's always something different. Even in COVID, when we couldn't actually socialise, they had virtual pubs and they had online yoga and meditation and
very good.
And we have, you know, the clinical-based wellness as well. We have, you know, the hot debrief model, which is run in our department, which is fantastic. You know, all the leaders in the department are taught how to debrief properly. And after every single recess, like hot, heavy recess particularly, but even the smaller ones, we have at least a hot debrief so that everybody is okay.
I think it's also really important for everyone who's in Melbourne, like where I am, there's like, I've got heaps of friends who are currently in hotel isolation. There's nurses everywhere getting taken out by COVID, as in, you know, having to be isolated. And there's just massive burnout, massive agency demand. You know, there's no regular staff in lots of places. So yeah, I think guys, just look after yourself. What is next for PodNed?
We're very excited about next month, aren't we? Next month's going to
be great. I think it's going to be funny. We're going to do an international episode and have a chat with some people.
Nice.
Who've worked all across the world in different, in emergency departments in, you know, all over the world. So we've got a few people lined up going to talk about their differences.
Some wonderful characters, shall we say?
Yeah, they will be quite funny, actually.
Well-chosen people.
Surprise. How does everyone find you guys? Like,
well, we are on iTunes, Spotify,
Google
Podcasts. I think we're still waiting for that one to go live. We're on Anchor, we're on Podbean. We're on a number of different
platforms. Got a Facebook page, LinkedIn page. So if Instagram you just search page. For us.
Yeah.
PodNed.
We have a little tiny marketing team keeping all our socials up to date. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Good job to Mr. Woodbridge. Yes. why the capital? Is it Nurse Emergency Department, NED?
Podcast for nurses in the ED.
Okay. Cool. Is there anything else that's happening? You got some awesome other people lined up?
Then we're doing in September, we're doing a wellness podcast.
Yeah.
We're going to
badly need it, I reckon.
Yeah, particularly.
I would say so.
Yeah. So we're going to get on our wellness guru from our department, and she's going to talk things, all things, you know, keeping yourself safe and healthy.
Yeah, and talking about some stuff that other places have done and things that people could implement in their own departments, like for, you know, not a lot of cost, kind of low-cost solutions, I think.
Budget.
Yeah.
Sounds like you're the ED everyone should want to work at. Sounds like a very
fun, you know what? We think so, but we might be a little bit biased.
I worked at quite a few EDs, and the team where we are at the moment is pretty awesome. And we do, we're very lucky. We get to innovate a lot. Mm. We're in fact encouraged to, you know, let's change things, let's do things differently, and yeah, it's a really good place to work. Great place to work.
That's awesome.
Come to Canada, Jackson. Yeah.
I probably will be next year for the Army. Who knows?
You'll be
I'll be Townsville, Darwin, or Brisbane, I believe. I don't know. I don't know. I might choose Brisbane. And do you have any final words for why people should join the crew?
It's fun.
It's good fun, yeah. It's hard work, but it's good fun, and the team is great.
We've just had a few hectic days. COVID, you know, has come back.
Rearrived.
We're right smack in the middle of the hot spot.
Oh, okay. So
hectic for the two of us. We've had to set up COVID clinics, but we just finished saying that even though it was hard yakka, we both did sort of, you know, 14-hour days, it has been like we wouldn't have it any other way. We were really happy to be the ones that were there amongst it. It's really good
to be a part of it and to be able to do something.
To feel like we've had
that opportunity as well.
Yeah, we've had a big contribution towards something that's just, it's just scaring everybody.
Devastating.
Really. We're just happy to be a part of it. So, yeah.
What other things have you guys, like what are your plans for your AD? For reshuffling the structure of your EDA, you're gonna have hot zones, cold zones.
We're already working in that space. It kind of was never disbanded from the original COVID a couple of months ago, March, April. So we have, some red zones designated, and then we have an orange zone for respiratory type patients, and then we have a green zone for non-respiratory or COVID, you know, suspect patients. And we've been running that since March, really.
Okay.
We just flex it, don't we, according to what's coming through. So we're kind of ready, but at the moment for us, it's all about the testing, because Queensland's been so safe for so long.
Yeah.
That now, it's just picking back up again.
Get your masks on, people. Okay, thank you guys for joining me. I think we covered some awesome topics, and I think that there'll probably be a few more questions that'll come through, so I might tag PodNed and get you guys to answer some. Sure. I hope everybody enjoyed watching, and I've got heaps and heaps of awesome things lined up. I've got GP nurse practitioners who've written for me. I've got ED nurse consult. Just so many things. I've got CEOs of peak nursing bodies. So we'll get a cool broad look into many things. I've got grads 6 months into the grad year, and so there's lots of cool insights and tips into nursing. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you.
Enjoy your girls' night out tonight.
We will. Probably the last one for a while.
Yeah. Enjoy it. See you guys.
Hey, thank you. Bye.
See ya. Bye.